From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
And remember, we've been saying it since day one in the face of this pandemic. None of us are safe until all of us are safe.
But you've just said that we have, you know, a huge pharma sector here doing very complex things, and yet we can't make vaccines in a pandemic.
Jimmy, it's great to see a team from Kildare in Croke Park any day of the year, isn't it, Jimmy?
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily. Who you leave your farm to can be a very divisive decision. Why can't we speed up vaccine production? And the dancing nuns of Askamore in County Wexford prepare for their big day. That's all on the way over the next hour of what most Brides of Christ who have music, who have rhythm, declare is an honest-to-God radio catch-up service. Let's start Playback Daily with the Ryan Tuberty Show, but not as we usually do, not a trawl through what used to be called papers, but instead this morning, let's go to Ryan reading some emails that the programme received about the Bull McCabe's favourite subject, the land. On Monday's programme, Ryan read an email from a man who felt he'd been cheated out of his inheritance on the farm. Overnight, the programme was contacted by a number of people who felt they were similarly affected. Ryan began by reading out a message from the original would-be farmer, responding to Monday's programme and the reaction to his story.
He has responded, having spent the day yesterday thinking about what was said on the programme. And here's what he has to say. Thank you sincerely for reading out my letter, and to your listeners for their compassion and empathy. I'm the man whose dream to farm was taken away by my parents and my brother. And it was suggested kindly by one of your listeners that I should talk to my parents. I tried to share some of my feelings several years ago, but unfortunately they have an incredibly narrow perspective that only sees the farm and my brother. And despite how they wronged me so hurtfully, I love my parents, but they are not the most approachable or reasonable people, and my father has a hot temper. They know very little of life outside of their farm bubble, which consists of them, my brother, and his family. In fact, they are barely able to hold a conversation about anything outside of farming and local interests. This part is very hard to explain or understand, especially for non-farmers, but my parents and brother have, possibly in their guilt, deluded themselves into believing that farming is the hardest job and everyone else is better off than them, despite their like of farming and the huge profits they make on what is a large dairy farm. They still tell themselves that I have what they sneer as a nice 9-to-5 office job, despite the fact that I regularly work 70-hour weeks in a stressful job that brings me no joy except it pays the bills and helps me save up for a small farm over a few decades. I don't deny that it's hard work, but so is my job and several other jobs, but without the huge satisfaction and rewards that come with working the family farm that you were privileged to be given, which, as I explained, would take 700 years to earn even on a good salary. It is like they tell themselves lies to help ease their guilt. It hurts deeply that they show almost no interest in me or my family or my job. I didn't include this in my original letter, but there was a day a few years ago when I heard some people in our locality talking, saying that my brother had to stay home and farm while I got to go to college. And this is the day where I contemplated not just killing myself, but killing my parents and my brother too, for this ultimate betrayal. This is why those tragedies struck a chord in me. They felt so guilty for choosing my brother over me after leading me to believe all my life that I'd be farming our family farm, that they spread rumours that I didn't want the farm. So they knew it was wrong. They know but just don't care. It's all about the farm for them. On that very dark day, it was only the thought of leaving my wife and children with that horrible legacy that stopped me. I'm in a better place now, thanks to ongoing counselling and a good wife and children that make life worth living for. But you will never, ever understand how that hurt and betrayal by your own family cuts like a sharp knife into my heart and into my soul. It haunts me every time I see my brother and his children on the farm, living my dream. So thank you again for sharing this and for your understanding, which was evident in the way you read my letter. Warm regards, a heartbroken countryman. And thank you for guarding my privacy, which of course we're going to do.
And then came what Ryan called the deluge. People from all over the country getting in touch to share their stories. And, as Ryan pointed out, he read them out because no one wanted to talk to the programme. They wanted their stories shared, but they didn't want to talk on air for fear of being recognised. We can't listen to them all on Playback Daily, obviously, but here's a flavour of the messages received by the show.
I come from a big family, but only one had any interest in the land. And he did get left everything, and that's fine. He worked it and continues the family tradition. None of the rest of us had the option, but we did help out as children. If we had not got educated and carved out our own careers, we really had no other support. And as I look back as an adult, the farmer in the family knew he was sorted. Farming was the only topic ever given time to at the family dinner table, but only one of us was ever going to go down that path. I just don't understand how everyone's interests were not given time. He loves the fact that he's been set up for life and feels he should have got more. He got everything. There's a lot of hidden resentment from the rest of the family, but to be honest, Ryan, being left the farm isn't all bells and whistles. He has no true relationship with any of his siblings. Connections and relationships can never be totally repaired. Land can never be recreated. But to have such a life wrapped up in money and your worth, that's not for me. Everyone matters in this world, not the amount of land you own. Another, my parents decided to carve up our farm for the first time since the famine years. It didn't go down well with the big brother, who, in fairness, deserved it all. The younger brother returned to the fold, having wasted his private schooling looking for his slice, and my kind-hearted mother decided to give him his share. Since then, the older brother has felt entitled to just about everything else also. The farm shares, the house, the poultry unit, etc., etc. It wouldn't be a problem if there weren't five others to be looked after. Well, in fairness, he has been a good brother, an amazing father, and is, like all fathers, thinking about his children. But that's where I would draw the line. His children need to buy their own houses, make their own way. It's very complicated. Where does it end? My poor elderly widowed mother has had to deal with all the fallout. Not fair after parents slogged selfishly for years and couldn't have been better.
Here's one from another angle.
That email yesterday really resonated with me. I live in Dublin and work in an office job. The most wonderful thing in lockdown was the ability to go home to the south of Ireland and work on my family farm. I loved working with my parents on the farm as a child. It's a much more enjoyable lifestyle. It makes me happier. I want that for my kids, but I'm a girl in my late 20s and have been trying to accept that it is my parents' wish that the farm goes to my brother because he is the male. And it feels unfair and archaic, but there's nothing I can do. I see my brother and his fiancée, who both work in office jobs in Dublin. I see them go home and walk the land and make plans for their life together. And it's so hard not to feel bitter. I'd love nothing more than to go home and work the farm for the rest of my life, like I did as a child. I don't know how I'm going to create a life like that for my kids. It's 2021, and a lot of women in Ireland spend their childhood working just as hard as their brothers, but for them, inheriting the farm is never even a consideration. As another one says, it doesn't just happen with farms. My parents signed the whole family home over to my sister. I have three brothers, one with special needs. My sister has loads of properties. She's the one who needs it the least in the family. Martin was on to say, Ryan, you've no idea how land, farming or otherwise, can divide families and the hatred and the greed that can come from it. Educate your children and sell off any land you may have and divide equally with your children. Let them in turn decide their own paths in life. Another says, my husband was treated like that man by his parents. The eldest son was given two large farms and a large house on each farm. My husband had a trade and has been through a couple of recessions, while the older brother has a very good lifestyle and has these farms to hand to his son. My husband's not bitter or annoyed over this, but I am, to a point that I've always had to work hard at any work I could get. I too look at this man and his son and how they have been handed a good life for themselves. Farmers really need to stop the old ways, giving all the land to one son. It's very unfair and it's hurtful.
Well, that's certainly clear from the emails and messages received by the Ryan Tuberty Show. And we'll have more on Ireland's relationship to the land later on Playback Daily. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, the question was asked, why can't we increase vaccine production? Matt Moran, director of Biopharmachem Ireland, a division of the business lobby IBEC, and Colm O'Gorman of Amnesty International spoke to Claire about their take on why the likes of Pfizer can't share their intellectual property and allow other companies manufacture their vaccines to speed up production. Colm O'Gorman was first up with his take.
About 10 countries have delivered 78% of all vaccines as of March, and most lower and middle income countries have yet to begin their vaccination programs. We're seeing in the news coverage every day not just huge issues around access to vaccines in the global south, but also around access to vaccines now in the global north, where companies have bought up in advance massive amounts of the intended production of vaccines, and where importantly billions of public money has gone into the pharmaceutical companies to produce these vaccines at the speed that they've been produced. So they've been produced because of billions of public money going into companies. And what we want to see is a provision at the World Trade Organization known as a TRIPS waiver put in place for a couple of years that would allow the setting aside of intellectual property rights for a period to allow for the massive ramping up of the production of vaccines so that they can be produced at the level that's needed everywhere in order for everybody to be protected. Because let's
so
be
in simple in simple terms, Colm, you want the vaccine recipe shared amongst producers so that any company that has the capability to make the vaccines can go ahead and do it.
There can be a whole range of voluntary licenses and other things that are put in place. But in order for us to get to where we need to get to, we need intellectual property rights waived for a defined period as provided for by the World Trade Organization so that production can be ramped up, so that everybody can benefit from access to the vaccines. And remember, we've been saying it since day one in the face of this pandemic, none of us are safe until all of us are safe. Even if we manage to vaccinate everybody in the global north, which we're not going to do based on where things stand at the moment, the world and all of us are still at massive risk because of this virus, because we won't have vaccinated sufficiently across the world.
Okay, Matt Moran, pharmaceutical companies aren't doing enough, and if they shared that information, that would speed up this process, which would benefit everybody.
Well, actually, sharing intellectual property would make very little tangible difference to the production of vaccines worldwide. The main issue here is the capability of companies to manufacture, not share IP. And in fact, in strong protection of intellectual property has actually, I suppose, driven the research, which has resulted in us finding vaccines far ahead of expectations. And even if you think further about intellectual property, it kind of is the fundamental, I suppose, platform that allows pharmaceutical companies to invest a lot of their own money in research and also to work closely with governments and research institutions to ensure that these kinds of diseases, such as COVID-19, are cured as quickly as possible.
I'm interested to find out more about why you say that sharing of intellectual property would not boost supply, because you'd be saying then that any company, any factory with the capability could manufacture these vaccines. Surely that would lead to increased supply.
The world has been scoured for manufacturing capability at the moment. And in fact, a number of pharmaceutical companies have already entered into licensing agreements with third-party manufacturers. So I think the issue here is protecting the quality of the product which is produced and ensuring that everyone in the globe is vaccinated and is vaccinated to the appropriate standards. I mean, manufacturing a vaccine is a highly complex and highly detailed process. For instance, it takes around about 60 days to manufacture a vaccine. And if you look to some of the major pharmaceutical companies, they tell me that takes 280 raw materials, 86 individual suppliers from 19 countries. The product has to be approved by a regulator, and you're looking at 41.
Yes, but that's the point. That's the key point. The regulator will look after the standard and the quality.
The regulator will look after the standard and the quality, but it's very important that the manufacturer has the capability to produce the product. And the world has been scoured for manufacturing capability, and by simply opening up IP, you're not going to increase your manufacturing capability.
Okay. Colm McGorman, what do you say to that?
I'm afraid it's. I simply don't agree. And by the way, neither does the World Health Organization. As Dr. Tedros, the head of the World Health Organization, said last week, the TRIPS provisions are there for use in emergencies. If now is not a time to use them, then when? So the World Health Organization is clear. And they explicitly support a TRIPS waiver. More than 100 countries support a TRIPS waiver. It's co-sponsored at the moment by 57 countries. And the countries who are opposing it, I mean, it's fairly clear here that this is driven by the economic interests of pharmaceutical companies and wealthy countries. So the countries that are blocking the proposal right now are the EU, and that includes Ireland, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, the UK, the USA and Brazil.
So you're saying ultimately the pharmaceutical companies want to make money off the back of these vaccines?
And listen, that's that's very clear from your other contributor there. Intellectual property rights allow pharmaceutical companies to make profits.
Matt, is that the case? Is that what's happening, Matt?
Can I finish this point there?
Yeah, I just want to clarify, Colm, whether that is the case. Matt, go ahead.
Absolutely not. Intellectual property allows companies to engage in research and to ensure that products and solutions can be brought to patients. I mean, the industry does support the COVAX initiative, which will make available 2.3 billion doses of vaccine to the world. And this is a collaboration which includes industry, the WHO and UNICEF. And the industry has always been committed to ensure that vaccines will be made available to low-income countries at cost. So it's in the interest of all of us to ensure that the world is vaccinated. And I don't think that you'll find the pharmaceutical industry wanting in that regard.
Colin?
COVAX is underfunded by $21 billion, which is about $11 billion at the moment, and it's only going to produce a limited supply. If we were to depend upon COVAX, for instance, its first round of allocations will only cover about 2 to 3% of participating countries' populations. It's simply not going to deliver at the scale that's necessary. And the pharmaceutical companies have not delivered COVID vaccines based on massive investments on their part. These vaccinations have been delivered in large part because of the investment of billions of euros of public money. Mm-hmm. And that public money should require that these vaccines are available in order to protect public health and to protect human rights. And all that's being asked is that countries would support the waiver of intellectual property rights in an emergency situation as provided for by the TRIPS mechanism to allow for the scaling up of the production of vaccines. The World Health Organization is explicit on this.
Okay.
And, you know, I can understand why pharmaceutical companies might argue against this because they want to protect mm-hmm. their bottom line and their intellectual property rights. But in the face of a once-in-a-century global pandemic, that's simply not good enough. This is an emergency situation and we need emergency measures.
Matt, it was interesting that the Taoiseach said in the Dáil about his discussion with Pfizer. He said Pfizer turned down his offer of support to start manufacturing vaccines at its Irish plant, saying that it had enough capacity at the main plant in Belgium, which had been reconfigured. And I wonder, is there an unwillingness to maybe stop or reduce producing profit-making drugs in order to start making more vaccines?
No. I mean, the reason that vaccines couldn't be made in Ireland in the short term is because we simply don't have the technology or capability to do it. Ireland is, a major location for the manufacture of pharmaceuticals, and we make a wide range of products here. Pfizer themselves have invested around about 2 billion euros in expanding their capacity to manufacture, and the majority of their vaccines are actually manufactured from a plant in Belgium, about 70%. And the way companies will work is they'll concentrate their capability into locations, given the sheer complexity of these processes. Mm-hmm.
But you've just said that we have a huge pharma sector here doing very complex things, and yet we can't make vaccines in a pandemic.
The manufacture of vaccines it's not a plug and play operation. You might have a chemical plant, you indeed could have a biotech plant, but it's simply. To manufacture a vaccine would require more or less a greenfield investment.
Colin McGorman, can I bring you back in here? Maybe we just don't understand it. Maybe it's just too complicated for us to get.
Well, you know, with the greatest respect to Matt, and by the way, I agree with what he says about its testament to the ingenuity of science and the ingenuity of those working within the industry that they've been able to produce vaccines at this pace. It's also testament to the massive amount of public investment and support from states, from taxpayers, from ordinary people that went in to make that possible, and the expedited process to get these vaccines approved and to market. So there's been massive state investment, public money put into this process, and we should be seeing the benefit of this coming out the other side. It's simply not okay that effectively we're in a situation now where the monopoly situation of a handful of small companies is effectively blocking measures supported by the World Health Organization, by more than 100 countries around the world, to ensure that production can be scaled up so vaccines can get to everybody who needs them so that we can all be safe. And I'm afraid it's not credible, with the greatest of respect to Matt, it's not credible for a small number of those companies to be saying that they're right, the World Health Organization, every other public health and human rights expert who supports this proposal is wrong. It's simply not credible.
Okay.
Colm O'Gorman of Amnesty International, who, along with Matt Moran, director of BioPharmaChem Ireland, a division of IBEC, was talking vaccine production issues on Today with Claire Byrne. County Kildare band Picture This played 5 sold-out gigs in the Three Arena in March 2019. They were supposed to be exploding all over 2020, but we all know what exploded all over 2020. And it's still 2020 in so many ways. But Picture This will be seen on The Late Late Show, the US one with James Corden, that is, tonight. And Ryan Hennessy and Jimmy Rainsford from the band spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line.
Ryan, what? Tell us about Croke Park. We played a single in a few minutes that you played in Croke Park. Tell us how you organise and what is the procedure for this evening? You've recorded it, obviously, because it began and it's filmed. It's an incredible video in Croke Park. Tell us about that, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you. We filmed it already. It was an amazing kind of day that we did there because, I mean, we got the word that they wanted us on the show, on the James Corden show. Things are different. And then our initial thought was we want the performance to kind of reflect the song. And the song is about how the whole world is different right now and how... trying to kind of give hope in a way, because I felt like there was a lot of sad music out there, which is also needed, but we wanted to release a song with a lot of hope in it for the world. And then we wanted to do a performance that would reflect that, so we thought we'd love to do it in Croke Park in an empty stadium, because it reflects where everybody is.
When did you film it, Ryan?
We filmed it last week because we had a deadline, obviously, to get it in time for the Corden show.
Because it was obviously social distancing. It was a big, big operation. Jimmy, it's great to see a team from Kildare in Croke Park any day of the year, isn't it, Jimmy?
That's right, yeah. It's great to actually be on the pitch.
Did the four of you not at the end, Owen and Cliff and Jimmy and yourself, and Ryan, did the four of you not do a lap of honour in Croke Park with the Sam Maguire? Because you'd be the only four from Kildare ever to do it at this rate.
Yeah, we never talked about that. We should have already done that. But hopefully we'll be back to do it another time.
Jimmy, tell us about the song that you performed on the Late Late, not the real Late Late, the James Corden Late Late. The real Late Late is on tomorrow night. But tell us about the song, because it is of our time, as Ryan said. It's the lyrics are really important. Tell us about the song.
Yeah, I suppose it's a song that Ryan has actually mentioned before about how it's a love song to the world. And I think there hasn't been much music from us that have kind of expressed what's going on at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I suppose this song is the best way for us to kind of describe how we're feeling with the world. And it's we're trying to get out a positive message, you know, that it's going to come back and it's going to be okay, really. You know, we don't want to dwell on the negative of what's happening now. We want to give out some positivity and say, no, it's going to come back, and that it's going to go. It's going to be okay for everybody, you know.
And as I said, March, go back nearly 2 years to the Three Arena, the Point Depot, as we all know it. Those incredible five nights. You could have sold 15 nights. And the astonishing stage show, and I don't know, it was part of a tour. What had you planned for 2020, Jimmy, before COVID-19 hit us?
Yeah, we had a lot of plans. You know, we had planned to play Malahide Castle in Dublin, Independent Park in Cork, and we planned to play Belsonic in Ormo Park in Belfast, and they were planned for June 2020, and it's. Mm. It was just kind of so scary to see how quickly the world kind of turned. Basically, overnight, it was pretty much this day or so last year when it really, really, really changed. And it was just, it was frightening in a way, I suppose, because, you know, it's our lifestyle as well is to play music and our career, and to kind of have it taken away almost instantly and it still hasn't come back in a year at all. You know, it was amazing it was amazing how much we take it for granted, I guess, and how much we depend on it. And I think just mentally as well, how much everyone depends on the creative arts as an outlet.
Absolutely.
And not being able to do that has been, it's been tough.
Ryan, would you introduce Things Are Different, the song that's going to hit the States tonight with a bang?
Yes, I will. This is Things Are Different, a love song to the world.
Some of us will drift apart while others stay together. Some will step in from the rain while others face the weather. Some will take the last breath while others breathe new life. And though they're standing on our necks, we still will to fight. 'cause things are different don't mean anything has changed. And I know the world's on fire, but there's beauty in the flame, and we don't know. We'll lose ourselves while others rediscover. The love is in the innocence, a baby to its mother. The sun will grasp it in the hands while others lose control. Yeah, we gotta leave our fingerprints so that the future knows. Different don't mean anything has changed. And though the world's on fire, there's a beauty in the flame. And we don't know how much longer, but we know.
Things are different from Picture This, the song that will be on The Late Late Show with James Corden on CBS in the United States tonight. Ryan Hennessy and Jimmy Rainsford from the band spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline. Following on from the deluge of correspondence to The Ryan Tuberty Show from people who feel they'd been cheated out of their farming inheritance, farmer, mediator and tutor Claire O'Keefe spoke to Ryan this morning about the difficulties and challenges that can arise in the area of farm succession.
Mediation is a skill, and one I trained as a mediator, and it's a skill that's applicable really for any challenging conversations arise.
Yes, for that's for sure.
And it's a good skill to have if you're working in the area of farm succession facilitation and farm succession planning.
One of the greatest TV shows of the last couple of years was Succession, based on a media empire, but at a global scale. But you got a sense of the almost military-like intricacies and struggles within a family to try and outplot and outhatch and outdo and outrun and outfox the others to get to the big prize. And the distinct lack of love is remarkable.
It can be, but yet families do have a desire to stay connected and to maintain family harmony. Generally, women, especially mothers, say, we want harmony, we want peace, whatever the outcome is.
We've been hearing some of the, Claire, I don't know if you've heard the emails and texts in the last day or two, but certainly you can see sometimes in a scenario, where the parents are left a bit bewildered by the mess that's unfolding before them, and they either choose to ignore it or they see it and can't deal with it.
And that's, yes. Generally, Ryan, when succession planning is a process.
Sure.
It's not just an event that one thinks about when one is in their latter years. It's a process. It needs to be begun in a timely manner. And I suppose the secret really is just open conversations at home around the kitchen table. If there is a farm here, it's a business perhaps for one person. And realistically, like, it can only perhaps be maintained by one, even if one can be the successor from that family unit. And, you know, sometimes if there's just one, a family with one child, mm-hmm. they may feel we've no option but to be the successor, and they may wish to do something else. So that can also be a challenge in families, where the one person who will be the owner of the asset may not want to be the actual farmer. So giving them the freedom also to do something else, while they can be the owner of the farm, is another conversation that can sometimes sure. be pushed under the mat.
Let me ask you, because I don't know, so I'm going to come from scratch, and I'm sure a lot of farmers will be saying, how can you be so stupid? But forgive the ignorance of the question, but I will ask you, as a city boy, what is the law of the land in terms of, let's say there's a family, mum and dad at the top, typically enough, and then down below you have, say, three sons and two daughters, the oldest being a son. Does the oldest son get everything? Is that still going, or is that a throwback?
I would like to say it's a throwback, but there may be assumptions and expectations, and that's what needs to be addressed. What are the assumptions in this family? What are the expectations? So addressing the assumptions of the parents and the expectations of the parents, and then asking the children, if they're adult children, you know, what are the expectations in this family? And you mentioned earlier on about a daughter who felt that she wasn't coming into the discussion of as perhaps ever being the potential owner of a family farm. And just looking at gender issues, you know, there may be a bias here. So just addressing that.
Mm. Yeah, but it sounds like the most, arguably the most patriarchal structure. And I mean that not in a sort of 21st century sense, but actually almost in a 20th century, and 19th century, but a very patriarchal structure that says father, son, father, son, father, son, ad infinitum.
Well, it is the most traditional of professions. Research has shown that it does transfer within the family of all professions.
And as a farmer, is that a bad thing, Claire? I'm asking, I suppose, a personal question now, but what's your thought on that?
If there is somebody within the extended, it can be the immediate family or the extended family, who wishes to pursue farming, you know, by all means bring them into the conversation. But one doesn't have to feel that one is obliged to.
So what I'm asking you, I suppose, in some ways, you're, as a mediator and a farmer, you're perfectly positioned to answer this question because you know both sides of the table in every sense. If we come into you as a family, myself, two brothers, two sisters, I would sit down and we say, right, the folks want to hand the family farm to our oldest brother, but the rest of us feel that that's really unfair because we get nothing having worked away on the farm as kids all our lives until we're 18. And we just want to know, can you help us here? Because the father wants to hand it to the oldest son, but the rest of us feel that's a grotesque injustice. So how do you help us?
Well, I thank you for taking the initiative and contacting me. However, the asset is owned by your parents, assuming that they are your parents.
Yes, they are.
And that they are together as a couple.
Yes.
And if they're both alive, that's really wonderful because one may be, you know, a widow or widower, and they may be suffering from a bereavement, and that can complicate things too. So what I say is the assets are owned by your parents. If they are mentally compassmentous and capable of having a conversation, we'll start with your parents. They are the asset owners. So it begins with them.
But I'm going to cross your rule and say, but our father is an immovable rock. He's saying there is no movement. It's my way or the highway.
Okay. So if your father has a will made, that's one question. If he has no will made, I would inform the family, well, 2/3 will go to your mother. While I'm not a legal expert, but this is 2/3 will go to your mother and the remaining 1/3 will be divided equally between the 5 children. And if that's what he wants, that is how it will be if he has no will made. If he has a will, then we can discuss, is it appropriate if they know what his will is? But if he's somebody who says, I'm not telling any of you what I'm doing, well, it's not my job
sure.
to shift somebody in that mindset.
You can be guaranteed in this scenario, that this role play that we're doing, that the dad
sure.
has written a will and the will says, oldest son, done. That's his one-line will.
And I suppose, Ryan, to be honest, a lot of people don't know what's in the will.
Mm.
And that's a bigger fear. They don't know. And the second fear then is that will could be changed. If my partner isn't acceptable to my parents, if I'm not doing exactly as they would like, there is a fear that that will could change and somebody else could change the plan that one person may believe that is the reality. And that's very, that's not unusual, that there is a fear. Wills, like we're not all going to, some of us will live hopefully to be elderly, and retaining assets until one is very elderly also has implications.
Keeping the farm in the family name, it says a text, is why this goes on. And another says, I'm married into a farming family and I had no idea of the toxic dynamic that can exist in farming families. It can take all your energies to try and maintain your positivity and reasonableness and let them get on with it. It's amazing that the focus on the stories we're hearing this morning, Claire, tend to be on the, I suppose, the negative side of things. Mm-hmm. But that's probably why people come to you. Don't go to somebody to mediate if you have the problem solved already.
No.
Another says, because of land and the houses, I pleaded with my parents not to leave me anything, not a blade of grass, for the sake of family unity. I'm the youngest of five boys. Inheriting isn't worth it. I'm not sure, says another, where all these successful farms are, but I doubt there are many in the west of Ireland. I am the oldest of two daughters. I got signed over the farm, a small holding in recent years, but my husband and I still work two full-time jobs to keep things going. Trying to run a farm at the same time means we have a little family time. Now, don't get me wrong, we love living in the countryside, but it's a lot of extra work and obligation. As a mother of four teenage sons, as another in a farming family, it's a constant worry for me that our family will be divided by the inheritance fallout. My husband doesn't speak to his brother because of land inheritance, and I do not want history to repeat itself. We have two sons interested in continuing on. I hope and pray that our family can stay united through all of this. What is the most common issue that comes up in terms of mediation, Claire, when it comes to the land?
Well, if it has reached a stage of where communication is broken down.
Yes.
But then we're reacting to a situation. But if people can be proactive and say, we just want help to work through some minor issues that are bubbling under the surface at the moment, then we have more opportunities to work with. So what are the main concerns? Realising that a farm is a very valuable asset, by and large, but the income of the farm doesn't reflect the value of the asset. And there is also, like, worth doesn't really come into it. It's identity as a farmer, and it's a farmer on that farm. That is, historically, that means a lot to people, that they are the farmer on that farm.
So
where sometimes I would say, well, would you consider farming somewhere else in Ireland? And quite often some people would say, no, it would be on my home farm where I was reared, where my father was reared, my grandfather or grandmother. So there's an attachment to place.
I can understand that.
Ryan Tuberty talking to farmer, mediator and tutor Claire O'Keefe about the contentious issue of farming inheritance on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. Travel writer Owen Corey has gone on a journey within himself and decided that he wanted to give up some stuff for Lent. It turns out, he told Claire Byrne this morning, he ended up giving up, well, pretty much everything. But he's been doing this for years.
I do this every year. It's a fairly simple formula to it. You take out the drugs, you take out caffeine, alcohol and sugar. Both caffeine and alcohol, well-rated sugar, obviously, is probably more dangerous than any. And that sort of, it's amazing how quickly the results would happen. Now, this is not a formula I advertise for other people, because I'm a great believer that people should compile their own a sensible approach to eating. And what happened to me a couple of years into when I was writing about travel was I just noticed I was putting on not a lot, maybe 3-4 pounds. I probably was stopping more active sport at the same time because of my age. And I just multiplied it by 10 and said, how am I going to do this in an environment where I don't control it?
3 or 4 pounds is nothing now. 3 or 4 pounds is nothing. But you're saying you're putting on that every year is what you noticed.
That's it. Multiply it by 10 and now you are beginning to say, how do I get it? It's much more difficult to get it back. So in an environment where you don't have a lot of control, you're eating out a lot, and I do really enjoy my food. I'm a great, my mother's theory that finishing your plate would help the starving children of Biafra. I took that seriously and I still do. I do, you know, even in environments where I'm fed local food, I will always eat and enjoy and appraise it. So in that environment where there's no control, how are you going to impose a diet? So take out the, I decided to do this based on what I'd read in some of the diet books. I used, in a previous existence, I was literary editor of the Irish Press and did the books pages of the Business Post a few years after the Irish Press closed. And what would you, every January, we'd be flooded with all these keto diets and Atkins. Do you remember the Atkins diet, Claire?
Oh, I do, yeah. The Ducan, all of
Louis
them.
Copeland, yeah. Louis Copeland used to remeasure the TDs every couple of months for expensive suits. It was
really?
A great when it was going. But they all say the same thing. Cut out the stuff that interferes, the bad stuff. And the list of bad stuff, the definition of bad stuff that piles on the weight, basically all those lovely desserts, that sugar. I take out red meat because that's very fatty. I take out bread because that can pile it on as well. But basically,
you know what?
Back
I want to
that
know
core,
what,
the alcohol, the drugs and the alcohol, the alcohol, yeah. The caffeine and the sugar.
I want to know what you leave in now, Owen. Like, what do you eat for Lent?
I love my vegetables. I love fish and chicken. And, you know, when you look at the list, it's very similar to what the Christian authorities and indeed the Muslim, like the Orthodox Lent started on Monday and the Baha'i fast ends on Friday. Ramadan will coincide with Lent next year. A lot of the religious authorities have been doing this for thousands of years. So they say take out meat. I do keep in fish because I always adore fish. It would be my choice. Chicken, all the vegetables I can eat and all the fruit. When they're serving up the pavlova at one of these meals away, I will always ask for just maybe 3 or 4 grapes. So I am sharing the dessert, but okay. I'm only having a little bit of fruit.
Sounds a bit miserable. Tell me what you had to eat yesterday. Started your breakfast.
Starting with the breakfast, I had some porridge and then I had fish for my dinner. And then another important sort of old, it's based on old wisdom, is that if you're going to start losing weight, you put some sort of threshold or curfew on your eating. You know the old phrase, breakfast like a king? That seems to be common across different cultures and different languages, that if you push your heavy eating into the morning and then, you know, it doesn't leave you hungry during mm-hmm. the day, you skip the eating late, and hospitality is terrible. Sometimes in Spain, you will be eating your main dinner after midnight. So if you push everything a little bit earlier in the day, it does a couple of things. If you're going to lose weight, you're going to feel hungry. It transfers that hunger into the time that you're sleeping. You wake up ravenous and you breakfast like a king again.
Okay, so you
it's
said
a great
now,
cycle.
You had porridge, right? And then you said you had fish. Did you have anything else? Fish and vegetables?
Oh, absolutely. Fish and vegetables. I don't regulate so much the amount of it. When I'm with the vegetables, with greens and potatoes, and I'm a great lover of potatoes, very patriotic about my potatoes. And then I skipped completely an evening meal. So what I'm...
So you're doing intermittent fasting as well.
Intermittent fasting in that you will stay off for a day or two or
no, well, you're eating two meals, you're finishing eating early and then you're
That's
not
right.
eating until the next day.
Yes.
It sounds painful. Claire called on dietitian Louise Reynolds to rule on whether Owen's Lenten swearing off is woke or whether it should be cancelled.
Really what Owen is doing here is crash dieting for 10% of the year. You know, so he's actually drastically reducing his calorie intake, and he's doing this by cutting out a number of these foods, some of which he doesn't need to cut out at all. And I suppose what dietitians we always say is, the reason that something is sustainable is because you can do it, you know, all year. You don't need to crash diet. And kind of this yo-yo dieting, now some people might do it 3 or 4 times a year and maybe not be as strict, whereas Owen has it down to one period, the 40 days, you know, that you're crash dieting for, and then the rest of the year you can go back to your normal diet. Now, the reason I suppose that as dietitians we're not so keen on that idea is that we know that weight cycling, which is another term for this, you know, it can come with an increased risk of type 2 diabetes later in life. Also, when you lose a lot of weight in a very short space of time, you know, you're losing some muscle as well. It's not all fat that you're losing. So you can't see that when you look at a body. You know, you can't see how much of that is fat and how much of that is lean muscle. And again, when you lose lean muscle, that does reduce your metabolic rate. And that's why then when you go back to normal eating, you know, you tend to put on the weight more quickly.
Yeah, but you However, know, if you look, you know, Louise, at what Owen is eating, Owen, sorry to talk about, you know, as though you're not there. So you're having porridge.
My family do that all the time, Claire, so it's okay.
Porridge, fish and veg. If there was another meal there, it probably wouldn't be too bad.
No, it wouldn't be. Now, the one thing, you know, I suppose that I totally get it. The business that Owen is in, it's really difficult when you are travelling. And I suppose this year has been different anyway with no travelling. But, you know, if you're in a hotel and you order a whole meal salad sandwich to your room, of course, it comes with maybe it's a triple decker sandwich and it comes with a side order of chips. And, you know, we all enjoy that. So it is very difficult when you don't have the control yourself if you're not cooking for yourself. So I totally understand that. But in terms of all of the things that Owen says he cuts out, you know, you don't need to be as extreme. Because, for example, dairy, you cut out all dairy foods. And yes, while we can certainly cut back on the butter and cream, because they really are extras in our diet that are quite high in fat and not full of nutrition. Whereas milk, cheese and yogurt, a lot of research has shown that, in fact, the calcium in these foods can help you to maintain a healthy weight. So that wouldn't be something that we would advocate. And similarly, red meat being fatty, when Owen says he cuts it out because it's fatty, again, yes, absolutely, cut out the chorizo, salami and sausages, but by all means include a piece of, you know, a piece of lean steak, because that is a really good source of iron.
Okay, but so, Owen, you want results, and what sort of results do you get over Lent?
I get very good results. I mean, it was very high at the beginning. I always ended up, interestingly enough, after... Louise's point is absolutely right. It's straight out of the dietitian. If you yo-yo diet, if you're going on and off, and I know people have been doing it for years, you put it back. I'm still below. I've always finished below the weight I started off with all those years ago. The other thing that has to be factored in is that I do eat copious amounts. I have a huge appetite normally. So cutting back on it isn't going to... probably brings me back to normal eating levels for other people.
That's travel writer Owen Corrie giving us the lowdown on his extreme Lenten sacrifices, despite the scepticism of dietitian Louise Reynolds, on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Ray Darcy did a quick virtual tour of the country, checking in on the virtual parades in various places for St. Patrick's Day. Here's one of them, as told by Helen Carney from Askamore in County Wexford.
We're a small community. There's less than 800 people here.
Aha, right, okay. And Sister Act, we were talking about this yesterday. So what are your plans for St. Patrick's Day celebrations?
So basically, we've organised a virtual parade among ourselves here in the community. We asked local children to get involved.
Yeah.
To take whatever pets or farm animals they had right. and video themselves having their own St. Patrick's Day parade in their gardens or out on the lanes around them. We've put them all together and then we've added in some dancing nuns.
That description is just brilliant. So gather up your pets and your farm animals and we're going to clip them all together and add in some dancing nuns. Who dreamt up that?
Well, I think I should add a disclaimer that none of us are actually nuns.
Yes, I know.
We're as far from nuns as you could probably get. But basically what happened is over the last couple of years here in Askamore, we've had a couple of fundraisers.
Yeah.
And in collaboration with our local school, Ballyellis National School, and our GA club, Kilrush Askamore, we've had fundraisers. So in every one, there has been a Sister Act group of sorts.
Okay.
So... we had habits and it seemed a shame to waste the habits.
Okay.
So over the last year during the lockdown, we've tried to keep people's spirits up. So the nuns have got the habits out and we have danced around the parish to try and showcase Askamore and the natural beauty that we have. The last one was a Jerusalem challenge a couple of weeks ago to help raise awareness of a walkathon that our GA club was doing.
Right.
And then obviously we decided that we'd do something for St. Patrick's Day, but it felt a little bit rude just to have dancing nuns. So we thought, well, look, we better ask the children of the parish if they want to get involved as well.
So what are the dancing nuns dancing to?
We're Irish dancing in wellies.
Right.
In a calf shed.
Okay.
Just general an Irish jig.
Okay.
Now, most of us have two left feet.
Yes. Yes.
So we're not the best Irish dancers in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you need any sort of dispensation from the church to wear habits and pretend to be nuns?
If you saw what we looked like in our habits, or you'd know that there is absolutely no doubt in anybody's mind that we're
real nuns. No real nuns here. Yeah, yeah. So that you've done that video already, have you? And it goes live tomorrow, or are you doing it live?
Yeah, no, we have done the video
yes,
already.
Great.
We needed to make sure that, you know, we weren't mobbed by paparazzi. So we've done the video already. Then one of our nuns has edited and added all of the other videos, the kids' videos.
Great.
And we've put it all together to music. So that'll go live on our Facebook page and our Instagram page tomorrow.
Right, tomorrow at 6 o'clock, is it? Is that it? Yeah.
Well, we'll probably go a bit earlier.
We want
to make sure that everybody sees it, right? You know.
Yes. Yeah.
So we'll probably go live at lunchtime tomorrow, and it was just an idea to get kids involved.
Mm. It sounds great. You know, you don't sound like you're originally from Askamore, Helen.
No, I'm not. I'm a blow-in. Most of the nuns are blow-ins, actually.
Are they?
I'm here 15 years, so I have probably at least another 30 years before I'm called a local.
And for those people who are trying to locate Askamore on the map, it's sort of inland from Gorey.
Yeah, we're about 10-15 minutes inland from Gorey.
Yes, that's where you are.
No, it's absolutely gorgeous. And
there's a lovely view there. It's sort of undulating hills, isn't there? There.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. We're so lucky down here. We have we're part of Wexford Walking Trails.
Yeah.
So we have a couple of walking trails up Slievewee Mountain, so you can see out as far as Camolin and the sea down us.
Right. Sounds idyllic.
River Chapel. Yeah. So it's
and on a clear
fantastic
day, you'll see a number of dancing nuns in the distance.
We never know where you're going to find us.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, listen. Good luck with that. Where will people find you if they want to watch the video?
They'll find us on our Facebook page, which is Askamore Community Council. Or on Instagram, it's Askamore_Wexford.
Great. Thanks, Helen.
That's Helen Carney from Askamore in County Wexford, although we know now she's only a blow-in, really, telling Ray Darcy about the town's virtual St. Patrick's Day parade, which will be available to view from tomorrow. Finally, on Playback Daily, today with Clare Byrne reporter Brian O'Connell, who's been trawling the small ads for years. He's even published a book on the subject. Found a particularly intriguing ad on his most recent trawl, as he told Clare Byrne this morning.
You do come across these ads from time to time where someone is looking for a person, and often they'll give a name of the person. Usually in my experience, Clare, if there's a contact number or an email, I'll often get in touch, and people are very slow to engage. And obviously that's very understandable, because these are ads where someone is looking to reconnect with perhaps a lost love or maybe find a parent. So in this case, the ad I saw was fairly simple. It was looking for a named person born in the 1930s, and they said they were trying to trace them or members of their family, and then they gave a contact email. Now, some of the details we're going to withhold for obvious reasons, but it culminated in me speaking with the person behind the ad. This person is Mike. Mike lives in England, and he began by telling me the background to his search and how, before his mom met the person who he thought was his father, she actually had another relationship.
Basically, she'd been an au pair in Korea to an American officer during the late 50s, and obviously as that conflict came to an end, everyone started to disperse. She was no longer needed as an au pair, so she sought passage back from Korea. She travelled back on a ship called the Canton. She struck up a relationship with a member of the crew, and that resulted in a romantic relationship. When they docked in Southampton, they went their separate ways, because obviously he was obviously sailing back and she was going back home. Within a few weeks or so, she realised that she was pregnant. She met somebody at a local dance. They obviously had a bit of a fling, and she then announced to him that she was pregnant. Obviously, in those days, it was not a good thing to be pregnant and single for a young lady. So he, thinking he was the father, did what you did in those days, and then married her. Obviously, it later transpired that he wasn't my father. Basically, when I was about 20, I found out that the person I thought was my father wasn't. I've been trying to trace him all that time. Obviously, I started pre-internet days, which made it very difficult. He was actually contacting organisations by letter and such. I didn't have his full details. And also, he wasn't on my birth certificate, which meant I came up against privacy issues.
Mike has been looking for his father for years. He told Brian what it was like finding out that the man he thought was his father was not, in fact, his father.
It's very hard to explain. It literally came on the back of a conversation, almost like a physical tsunami of emotion went through me. I remember almost feeling dizzy, you know, almost falling over, because physically felt like it went through my head and just washed away in an instant half of who I thought I was. The ironic thing was that I always got on better with my father's side of the family than I did with my mother's. So suddenly they weren't actually my family. You don't realise how much you base who you are on your family, your upbringing, and those interactions that you grew up with. To suddenly have those all questioned or taken away is quite a traumatic thing. And I'm sure, you know, this probably happened to other people, but for me, it really did stun me.
And I gather your mum was reluctant in a way to go back into it.
She was aghast that I'd been told and said it didn't matter, it's all in the past. There was this sense of shame, embarrassment about the whole situation. Mm-hmm. And if I'm honest, at that time I was angry with her. Nobody would give me any further information at that time. And it took me a while. I had to gradually tease bits of information, particularly out of my mother. I said, well, just tell me his first name. Mm-hmm. So I got that, and then it, you know, maybe 6-9 months later, I sort of said, well, what was his second name again? So that's when I started on my research. You know, how many ships were sailing from Southampton to the Far East at that time? I found out there were two, narrowed it down to one, and went on from there.
And lo and behold, there was a man with the name you'd been given on that ship, and you believe he came from County Cork originally.
Yes, it took me 20 years to establish that. Because again, I couldn't get information, but then I was searching the National Archives and they release information every 50 years. And his name suddenly popped up. There was this person serving on that ship. It also had his seaman's crew card with a photograph of him at that age when he signed on in 57.
Do you believe that he was told of your existence?
Apparently, yeah, because later on I had a conversation with my mother and she said that they had stayed in contact and she told him of the situation and he had offered to help. But by that time, she had obviously made other arrangements, we say. They decided to leave it at that. It's not a case of finding him to, you know, confront him or challenge him. It's just basically to try and fit in a few gaps in my life. You know, nice to know who he was, what he did.
Mike told Brian that he put an ad in a newspaper, but nobody, aside from Brian, has replied as of yet. But maybe someone who knows his father was listening to the wireless this morning. You never know. Brian O'Connell on a fascinating small ad search on Today with Claire Byrne. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.